This is DNFM. I'm Sam Solomon. DNFM features the latest stories in design and tech, brought to you by Designer News. Welcome back, everybody. This is episode 8. Every now and then, you'll meet an artist or a designer, other creatives that just have this incredible drive to make things. And sometimes the sheer amount of things they're able to produce and the quality of the things they produce is incredible. I believe that today's guest, Jessica Hish, is absolutely one of those people. Jessica is a letterer, illustrator, and type designer. She's got clients that include the New York Times, Nike, Target, Tiffany & Co., NPR, Samsung. The list could go on, but I think you get the idea. She is also the author of In Progress, a book which goes in-depth about the creative process behind her lettering work. This is going to be a longer interview, so we'll have a few announcements, go into job listings, and then we'll get right into my conversation with Jessica. Admittedly, I don't have a whole lot of announcements for you all this week. I do want to thank everyone who came out and joined us for our most recent event in San Francisco. We do hope to be back soon. I don't have any updates on future Designer News meetups for you all right now. Obviously, if you listen to the show, if you spend a lot of time on Designer News, which I'm sure you do, we'll post updates there. I am going to change things up a bit this week. So instead of doing our job listings during the show, we'll go ahead and do them right now and then get right into the interview. So as far as our featured listings, Cardio is looking for a senior graphic designer in either London or San Francisco. Delighted is looking for a UI engineer in Palo Alto, but Delighted is remote friendly. So if you're looking for a new job, a new gig, you can find all of those listings and several more on designernews.co/jobs. All right, let's get to the interview. My guest today is Jessica Hish. Jessica is a letterer, illustrator, and type designer. Her clients include the New York Times, Target, Nike, and many, many others. She is also the author of In Progress, a book covering the creative process behind her lettering work. Jessica, thanks for joining me.
Happy to be here.
So one of the things I didn't mention while introducing you is another one of your clients is Wes Anderson.
Yes, indeed. I worked on the titles for Moonrise Kingdom, which wasn't the most recent film, as everyone knows, but it was a film.
Well, the reason I ask is because I'm curious, how did you end up with that gig?
You know, it came about how a lot of projects end up coming about, which is like some random person brings up your name in a meeting when everyone's trying to like spitball and throw out ideas. So what ended up happening for that one was they were working with another designer, but that designer is more on the calligraphy end of things and works with a type designer to finalize his designs. And I'm not sure like why it didn't work out with him, but I assume that part of it was just because the feedback schedule was really fast. And because I could do everything end to end, I think they were looking for someone that could do all the type design themselves. And so when they reached out to me, I think, you know, they had gone through a bunch of work with this other person and were kind of just in like, we need to get this done mode. And so it was a pretty, you know, tight timeline. But once we nailed the style, you know, everything went pretty smoothly from there on out. And the biggest challenge was just, you know, Wes is like a visionary of what he wants to do. And it was just about me sort of trying to look inside his head to get design, you know, to be final. And I think what really was weird is that, you know, a lot of things that designers go through when they're working with a client, like getting incredibly specific feedback about something that they, as a designer, have more expertise in than the client does, your natural inclination, because it's been kind of like built into us from listening to design podcasts or like, you know, just our own interactions with clients, is to resist, you know, to like go in and be defensive and defend your work, you know, and all this kind of stuff. But I think the thing that really made that project succeed is how open I was to his criticism, because I trusted him so completely. And I think that what came out of that project for me is that I try to pretend like every person that I work with is a creative genius that I trust completely. You know, and I mean, clearly, obviously, you want to push back on things when clients suggest things that are not right for the project and that, you know, there is a better solution, but it makes me approach feedback differently, where I always assume that their feedback is correct and the burden's on me to disprove it, you know.
That's interesting.
Rather than immediately saying all feedback is not right, or trust me, I know what I'm doing, you know, like coming at them and saying like, hey, I know that you want me to change it to blue, but blah, 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 you know? So I think that was really good. And it really, like, I think that one of the things that most people that are, I'm not like far along in my career. I mean, I've been doing this for like 10 or 11 years, but, when you get to this stage, you know, it's really difficult to have that same, like, just starting out mega enthusiasm where, you know, you're in like just happy to be here mode, and whatever you can do to like get yourself back in just happy to be here mode is a good thing, I think.
Well, so what are some of the things you're working on right now?
Well, right now, so I'm working on a bunch of different stuff. One of the things that I'm working on is I'm working on a project with Apple to make a huge piece of art that's going to be displayed.
You can't talk about it, right? Like big NDA, right?
Yeah, probably. But I think it'll be live like soon enough. So, but they've done this with other artists before. So I won't tell you specifically what I'm doing for it. That can be like the big unveil.
Okay.
But they've done some work with artists where that artist creates artwork on an iPad Pro, and then it's used on their enormous displays in their stores. And the thing that's cool about it is, like, because I'm using Procreate, and I don't usually draw in Photoshop and stuff like that, and it's all very, like, new to me, but the Apple Pencil actually is pretty, you know, I'm pretty into it now. Like, you know, which makes me feel a little hypocritical because I just released this whole book about how important it is to, like, keep 100% of your a big part of your process analog. And I'm just, like, sketching and on the iPad. So much fun. But, the thing that's neat is that Procreate records your strokes as you, you know, create the artwork, so then you can play it back as a video. So I've actually posted a few of these kind of me getting familiar with the tool experiments on Instagram, and everyone has just been like losing their minds about it, which is really fun. Because I think, you know, you can talk about your process and you can show the sketches and you can show the final, but when people actually sort of see the decisions happening, like, you know, sped up, of course, but, you know, seeing them happen in real, like, quote unquote, real time, it's just really, it's, you know, you can sit there and watch it on loop, you know, I found myself doing the same thing for other people's artwork. It's just very, you know, meditative and interesting to watch.
Well, Randy Hunt, who was a guest in a previous episode, he basically forgone a laptop for a whole month and was experimenting just using the iPad Pro as his main computer. Are you in that camp at all?
That, no, because all of my final art is done with vector. And the main thing is that in the vector environment, I've actually found that anything that's like tablet-like isn't the ideal thing for me, because when you are using a tablet or Wacom or Cintiq or whatever, you're doing a lot of like tense hovering with the, when you're doing plotting vector points, which is very different from being in Photoshop where the pen is always down and you're, you know, creating these strokes. And it's that tenseness in your hand that actually I feel like my, you know, latent, carpal tunnel kind of ends up coming out a little bit faster, when I use a tablet than when I use the mouse, because when I use a mouse, I can just let my hand rest on the mouse and
right.
just click when I'm, you know, be more intentional about when my points are being plotted. So I don't think that I would be like praying for the day that some amazing vector program is on the iPad, but you know, who knows. What I am excited about though is that I still want to do a lot of my sketches with pencil, because I just find it's really difficult for me to separate when I'm on a computer because there's way too many distractions. And that's one thing that I do find the iPad is better for, because like the rest of my work life internet is not as good on the iPad as it is on desktop. It's much easier for me to get distracted in browser windows on the desktop than it is on the iPad. And that's just like app environments, you know, like the wall-to-wall app environment versus little windows all over your screen. But I am really excited about having it just as a way to create kind of the in-between sketches to finals, because I don't usually make comps for my art, because I find that sometimes if the art is too finalized looking, then clients like fall in love with some particular piece that's in the sketch and really want it to be in the final, where when I'm creating the final, I might find that that piece should be eliminated because of the layout or because of whatever, you know? And so I tend to send sketches that are a little less like, you know, a little more raw so that I have more room to play when I'm making the final. And if my sketches are too close to final, then I get a lot of feedback like, well, the crossbar on the F was lower on the sketch. And I'm like, oh God, you know, but there are, you know, there are projects where if like, I do feel like if I could present a more, you know, tight sketch that like when I'm working with a client that's used to seeing stuff that's more comped up or isn't very visual or, you know, like thinking about logo projects and things like that, where a logo project, you usually are not showing sketches, you're showing just the final art. And I feel like the iPad could be a good in-between where I could show a sketch, but the sketch would be tight enough that it wouldn't look like I was just like fucking around basically. Like, cause that's, if I show pencil sketches to a logo client and I need 2 weeks to complete those pencil sketches, it looks like I've just been wasting time for 2 weeks and sent over a doodle. Whereas, you know, when you're used to seeing a logo deck, it's like a really finalized, you know, put together logo deck. So I could imagine using tighter sketches that are created on the iPad as part of logo presentations for sure.
I'd like to go back and talk a little bit about your background, because I think that's pretty awfully interesting about how you got to kind of where you are. You grew up in Hazleton, Pennsylvania.
I did.
There are a few designers, but I don't imagine there's a large chunk of designers in that town.
It's funny. There's not a lot of designers. There's actually a lot of people from the kind of Scranton, Wilkes-Barre area. Like Liz Danzico is from Scranton, and the heads of state, one of the heads of state, Jason Kernovich, is actually from my hometown, but we didn't know that when we first met and didn't find that out until later because he's like 5 or 6 years older than me. So it's not like the artiest of towns for sure, but there are a few of us that have ended up out and about. But there's a fair amount of Northeast Pennsylvania folks that have made it out into the world.
Well, and I'm curious, is that when you were younger, did you have this affinity for art or just like creating things in general, or did that not start till later?
Well, I always had an affinity for art, but I just had no idea how that was going to translate into a career. Like, I just knew that I love to draw and that people seem to like it when I draw, and that somehow like doing things that not only I like, but that other people like to see me do would translate into success somehow. And I guess that's kind of the truth about anything, you know, like if you love it and then when you do whatever it is, other people also seem to love it, like you've hit on something. But I was not like a planner. I've never been a person that like has a 5-year plan. And it's only now that I have a child that I have to actually start being that kind of person. But yeah, I mean, when I was in college, I thought I was going to be a painting major and then would figure it out or something. I don't know. And, but when I took design classes, it all just kind of clicked, you know, like
what classes specifically?
Just, you know, intro to graphic design, you know, kind of thing. So, the school that I went to didn't have an industrial design program or anything like that. I think I probably could have enjoyed that as well. But I took an intro to graphic design class because it's just what everybody does. You know, basically, like, your parents make you do it to disprove that you, to prove or not prove that you can find a career in the arts, you know? And
that didn't work in your case.
In my case, I was like, this is great, you know? But I think that's what all parents want. They want them to take graphic design and then realize that there's a 9-to-5 job as a part of being an artist. But there was also this like, you're a sellout aspect of loving graphic design, from all the fine art majors. But, what was really great about it is I love making stuff. Like I just could make stuff all day long, and the actual process of making things and like being in the middle of making something is the thing that I enjoy. And what I found with basically everything fine art was that I felt so much pressure about what it was going to be, you know, because it had to be self-expressionistic and it had to have a statement or whatever. And that all had to come from me. And what design and illustration brought to me was it took that pressure away, because I was still creating something that I could have, you know, me be a part of. But I was creating it for someone else based on their needs and their brief. So it didn't feel like I could make anything. It felt like I could make something really specific. And having these sort of really tight briefs helped me just get started with creating. And that's what I really like about design and illustration, is that the actual pathway to get your hands dirty, you know, if you consider plotting vector points getting your hands dirty. But the entry to that is really easy. You know, basically you get a project brief and you could start working on it immediately if that brief is incredibly tight. And if it's looser, you spend a few days ideating, a week or two, like coming up with sketches. But then after that, like even those sketches are all based on a specific need, you know. And I just loved it immediately, like put all these light bulbs on for me. And all my friends that were like, you're a sellout, be a designer. Like, why don't you like figure out how to make a living being an artist, like the real way. I was like, this is my real way. You know, this is what I always wanted to do, but I didn't know that it was a thing. And now I know it's a thing. So I'm going to do it.
Well, and your parents, I believe, were professionals too. They were scientists and dentists, right? Did they put pressure on you or like, did you feel pressured?
My dad's a dentist, and I think he never really put a ton of pressure on me to like pursue a science life, just because both of my parents always saw from when I was a little kid that I was like, nope, this is what I like. This is what I'm going to do. I've got it, blah, blah, blah. And I was just kind of driven towards something. And I think that that's all that you kind of really hope for with being a parent, is like your kid has interests and they're pursuing them, and they're like, they have a huge desire to like be independent and to be their own person and to, you know, find a thing in the world that they love to do and to figure out how to do it all the time. So even though they didn't have an art background, they really just encouraged that because they saw it so clearly in me that it was something that I was interested in. And my mom, she was trained as a scientist, but ended up, she was a stay-at-home mom when we were growing up. But what was good about having her around is that she actually, I mean, there's a lot of things about having her around, but one of the things that was great about her, what she specifically brought as a mom, was that she's actually really creative and, you know, was always participating in these sort of like crafty things. And we had lots of craft supplies all the time. And, you know, both she and my dad were really good about keeping lots of art supplies around the house. And I think that a lot of people that don't come from, you know, creative backgrounds don't do that. So I think I was really lucky in having like two parents that were completely fine going out and like buying crazy, like 300 unit pastel sets for me when I was like, you know, 11 or something, you know, things that not a lot of parents would do if they didn't understand like what a career in the arts was.
So one of the things I've read or heard somewhere is, I think you said that when you were in college, you started drawing letters because you couldn't afford to buy fonts. Is that true? And is that true? And is that really kind of where you started lettering? Is that how you got into that?
Well, it's how I got into it, but it's not how I found it as a career.
Okay.
So I was really into people that did hand lettering as a part of their projects when I was in college, but I always assumed that it was like a component of a design project rather than its own thing. You know, like when you're in design school, I think if you're at the kind of school that I was, which is very hands-on and like you are creating things end to end, you sort of think like, okay, well, I got to learn this skill because I want to make a thing that looks like that for this. And clearly I'm not going to hire someone else just to like do that thing, when really that's how like 100% of the design world works. But, with the lettering work, like, you know, you had so few typefaces on the computers at school and on my laptop, and people would pass around those like 10,000 fonts, like CDs and things like that, which were just all downloaded from like defont.com and were terrible. And rather than try to take something that was super mediocre and make it work for my project, but have to make a ton of adjustments to it anyway, I ended up trying to draw things from scratch when I could. You know, I started like a lot of people where I would take an existing typeface and make adjustments to it. Like, say I wanted to make something that had like a cool swash thing off the S, but the typeface didn't have that. I would just figure out how to draw on that swash, or figure out how to change the K to look a little bit differently or something like that. And that was kind of my gateway. And then after that, I started trying to draw things from scratch, which all ended up looking like, it's like the same alphabet structure with lots of different doodads on it, you know, basically. which is another thing that I noticed in a lot of young lettering artists design, where they use the same basic skeleton and then just draw like different thicknesses or different serifs or whatever. But ultimately they're basically making like one giant superfamily because the style or like the bones of it are the same.
After college, you moved to New York to join Louise Philippe. A lot of the work she was producing was very type focused. I'm curious, how did working with her and working with type, how did that influence your work?
Well, so this is another thing, is that even when I worked for Louise, she wouldn't call herself a letterer. You know, like I think now she would probably say that lettering, like that she does a lot of lettering for projects, but she's still a designer. And like, because of it being a design studio, I thought, oh yeah, I'm not a lettering artist. I just am a designer that draws letters as a part of my project. And, but working for her, what it added to my work was a lot of discipline that wasn't there before. You know, she works with historical resources like all the time. And I was interested in doing work that was like that, but the kind of work that I was doing on my own was a lot more loose. Like it's like I didn't have the historical references to look at in order to make the super tight things. And the ones that I did have were kind of like the things that were trendy at the time. Like there was a lot of like 50s, 60s kitsch kind of you know, food packaging, that kind of thing, which was like having a mega moment in the early to mid 2000s. And working for her sort of opened up my inspiration world into like a ton of different genres of typography. And then also just because her style is a lot tighter than what I was producing at the time, I just learned how to work more tightly. And it ended up, I realized that while I was working for her that like I wanted to focus entirely on drawing letters instead of focusing on doing like the design in general, because it was the part of the project that I loved the most.
What was the most impactful thing you learned during your time there?
You know, I think the most impactful thing isn't actually a design thing. It just has to do with, you know, how to be a professional and run a business. So I think like the skills that I learned from working for her were about how to respect people that have been in the profession for a long time, how to, you know, work with historical references in a way that is sensitive to, you know, to what you're looking at, so that you're not just, you know, copying whatever it is, you're, you know, taking it and making it something new. And then also that you can run a successful business without running yourself into the ground, because like you're in charge of workflow ultimately. So if you're working from 8 a.m. until 2 a.m. every day, that's your fault. It's not like the fault of your clients. And I think that sort of jumping from the job that I worked before working for her, which was at Headcase Design, which was an amazing experience, but they did work longer hours, to working for Louise, who super disciplinedly 9 to 6 every day. I think I worked till 7 p.m. like 2 times. And just seeing that that was possible, that you could still be like high output and quality output without it killing you, really influenced my decisions on how to run my business later, because I just sort of knew that it was possible to, you know, not work like a crazed 22-year-old for the rest of your life.
I mean, I feel like I kind of understand that. I've worked in the agency world, and it does feel like there are a lot of days where there's just everyone's putting out fires all the time. Like it is like chaotic. So, well, you worked for her for a couple of years and then you decided to leave and start freelancing. What prompted that decision?
When I graduated college, I lived in Philadelphia afterwards for another year. And a lot of my friends left Philadelphia. A lot of the friends that I graduated with left Philadelphia pretty immediately because there weren't a ton of design opportunities there. So the people that I ended up hanging out with were freelance illustrators that were a few years older than me. And what ended up happening is that I sort of saw what their work was like and what their life was like, and thought to myself, like, oh my God, this is actually what I've wanted to do this whole time, is like I wanted to be an illustrator, because it is exactly what I've always wanted to be when I was growing up, which is like to be an artist that draws all day. And it has the same aspect as graphic design, where clients are coming to you with specific needs and you are filling those needs. And so it was like all of a sudden I had this major eureka moment. Like, I want to be a freelance illustrator. That's actually what I was supposed to be. And so I started pursuing freelance clients, and it was in that pursuit that I actually got the job working for Louise, and which was super random. I sent her a promo for my illustration work, and she called me in for an interview and hired me. And so even after I got that job, I wanted to keep pursuing the freelance work because I really felt like ultimately that's where I wanted to be, which made it really, the time that I was working for Louise was the most inspiring, but also like some of the hardest time because I was working just all kinds of hours. I would work from 9 to 6 for her and then go to the studio and work from like 7 until 1 in the morning. And then I worked every weekend, and that went on for like over 2 years. And it just came to a point where like I realized that the work that I was doing freelance was starting to be really interesting. Like, it wasn't just like, oh, here's a job, do this job. It started to be like really cool and stuff that I actually really wanted to do. And then also I was getting jobs that were paying well enough that it was actually, you know, my freelance work was starting to surpass my salaried job in terms of what kind of money I was making. And that's a really rare thing for people that are trying to transition to freelance, is they, you know, usually take kind of a leap and hope things will turn out okay. But there was like a pretty clear signal that I was getting, like, hey, like, you can do this. Like, now is a good time. It didn't feel scary because I knew that I had all this work coming in already, and that the thing that was scary was that I'd be, you know, losing my healthcare and losing the consistency of a salary job. And everybody that's freelance for the first like 10 years of their career is like, this is the last job I'll ever get, you know, every time a new job comes in. But there was something about it, like, I was still living pretty cheaply and, you know, pretending like I was broke all the time. And because of that, it wasn't as scary as it could have been. So it just, the timing was right and I was ready to do it. And then I've been freelancing ever since. You know, now I try not to say freelance because depending on what industry you're in, it gets misread as being in between jobs or
I'm consulting.
yeah, exactly. Or it gets, a lot of people assume that I'm available for in-house work and things like that, which I'm not. So I try to say that I run my own studio and it's a studio of one, you know, and I've definitely debated on hiring employees. But I'm not ready to be a manager. You know, like I feel like my ultimate goal is just to spend as much time making stuff as I can. And I'm worried about the transition to having employees as me transitioning out of making and into managing. So
yeah, less time to actually do the work and more time trying to help other people do the work.
Yeah. That said, I mean, I see people that have been able to hire employees and whatnot. And just to see that your office keeps moving when you're not available is pretty cool. So it's definitely something that I need to think about in the future, transition from freelance to proper studio ownership.
Well, so when you started freelancing, that gave you time to start working on side projects and kind of make some of the just different things that weren't necessarily related to client work. One of those projects really accelerated your career, the Dropcat project. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So for Daily Drop Cab, when I quit working for Louise, I was really concerned because most of my illustration clients that I was working with weren't hiring me for lettering work. They were hiring me for doing like more regular narrative illustration work. And I had started to get the ball rolling with the lettering projects, you know, incorporating lettering work into that illustration work, but it wasn't a huge chunk of my portfolio yet. And I wanted to make sure that after I left working with Louise, that I was still have an excuse to keep practicing lettering and trying different things and experimenting. And so originally I thought maybe I would, you know, do an alphabet a week or something and do it for a whole year. And I realized really quickly that that's really ambitious and I needed to scale it down. So what I scaled it down to was to draw a letter a day, and I would just work through the alphabet. And then I set a goal for myself to do it 12 times. And the only reason why I chose that is because I was like, okay, well, what can this project be? Like, maybe it could be this. Maybe it could be a book. Maybe it can be a calendar. Calendar makes sense. 12 alphabets. There you go. And so I started doing that. And I have always been kind of like an active online person. I was like a MIRC person in high school and things like that. And you know, was on every modern social media thing when it started. But I joined Twitter in 2009. And that's when I quit working for Louise. and was really involved with design community people on there. And, you know, when I launched Daily Drop Cap, just sort of posted, you know, a link to it, like, oh, here's this project, check it out, I'm doing it. And I had it on Tumblr originally. And I said, yeah, I'm going to post a thing every day, go check it out. And at the time, there weren't a ton of people doing like a thing a day projects.
Right. Now there's a ton of them.
Now there's a ton, which is awesome. But there weren't a ton at the time. So it was kind of a novel thing. And the other thing that was a little novel about it was that part of the project was I wanted people to use them. So I included like a little snippet of like, hey, if you've never put an image into a blog post before using code so that you can not have to like upload the image, copy this in as the first letter and then you can use it as long as it's not a commercial thing. I feel totally comfortable with it. No big deal. Personal blog beautification. Go for it. And people really liked the kind of sherry nature of it as well as just like it's a pretty thing to look at every day. And so it really just went crazy. You know, everyone, I got so much press for it.
And one of the things I want to ask you is all you doing is sharing this on Twitter? Like where did this traction come from?
Yeah, I was basically just sharing it on Twitter, but I was, you know, I was living in New York. I shared a studio with, you know, I was in this studio building called the Pencil Factory with a whole bunch of other illustrators that were, you know, pretty prominent in the illustration community. But I was also friends with a lot of designers that were super involved with, you know, AIGA and ADC and, you know, even just being friends with Tina Eisenberg from Swissmiss and like her posting about it. And so it was sort of like I had built up this network of people just from living in New York and being super social and extroverted and being like, I love everything. I wish I could just be at a design party all the time, you know, and that all really helped. Like I had everything was in place for when the project launched so that, it got as much attention as it possibly could just from even the New York design community. And then because it was, you know, a pretty interesting project, that was a little on the nerdy side because of this, like, you know, here's a code snippet implementation. I got asked to talk about the project a lot too. So what ended up happening was the project actually kicked off my speaking career, which I wouldn't really like call it until now that I have this like separate speaking career, but it kind of is, now that I've spoken at like 70 conferences or something.
Now that you're talking with me on this podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's through being asked to like share my story that, you know, people started paying attention, not just to that project, but to the rest of the work that I was doing. Cause I think, you know, we can all sort of notice that is that the people that you want to follow on social media are not people that you're just like, oh, here's a pretty thing. They're people that you feel kind of connected to their life in some way, you know, and you want to root for them and you want to, you know, you're like excited that this person is out in the world that's doing cool stuff that you feel like you have this connection to because they somehow are like a version of you out there doing it. And I think because I was so oversharey online and, you know, open with my life and everything, I made a lot of like internet stranger friends and continue to do that. That, you know, we help each other in so many ways. Like they write me these amazing emails about how a piece that I did like help inspire them to do a thing. And then that inspires me to want to do other stuff. And then, yeah, it's this awesome, like weird inspiration circle that is.
Did you have other projects that you were working, other side projects before the Dropcat project, or was this really the first big one?
That was the first big one because I think before that I would have thought of a side project as being like a student project kind of, you know, where like there was this stigma I felt like when I was getting out of school where the whole thing was you wanted to replace stuff in your portfolio with client work because client work was real work and like, you know, student work was student work and you could do whatever you wanted. So like you can't really judge it in the same way that you do client work. And you notice that with competitions too, with like design competitions where the like uncommissioned category is its own thing. And it's the thing that gets the most entries because it's the easiest to create uncommissioned work because making amazing work for clients requires a really excellent client to come to you and then to like be open enough to be into cool things. So I didn't do a lot of art projects that were side projects before this. And then even then, since then, I haven't done a lot of side project art, you know, art projects. Most of my side projects have been to satisfy other parts of my brain that I don't get to
work. You're just exploring.
yeah, I'm just exploring. So like, I really wanted to learn how to do like HTML and CSS. And then I would build a side project that was website based specifically because I wanted an excuse to build a website, you know, or I actually made, and then after I felt like I had a handle on it, I was like, this is amazing. Why don't more people know how to do this? It's crazy. And then, so I put together a whole side project that was just teaching people HTML and CSS in a way that was more accessible than some of the resources that I found that were out there, because there's a lot of amazing resources for learning how to do web design, but they're also really, really in depth. And it can be difficult when you're first starting out to know where to start, you know, like you start and it seems like there's this mountain of knowledge to learn. And I wanted to figure out how to distill stuff down. So that's why I ended up making Don't Fear the Internet. And then there were a bunch of other projects that sort of came about just because I was like, oh, I wish this thing was real. I'm just going to make that thing. Like, if I can do it in a weekend, I'll make that thing. And so most of my side projects came out of like a couple of really productive years in which I would be on fire about a certain topic. And then I would just work for 16 hours a day for like a few days in a row. And then boom, it would be live. And then I haven't created a ton of side projects since then, just because, well, web-based ones, because when you output like five or six, like basically internet startups at the same time, you don't realize that those things need maintenance and they need, you know, you to continually pour content into them and things like that. So, I sort of made a restriction with myself where if I was going to make another web-based project, it would need to be like static. So I could only put something online if it was just going to be there and that would be it. So, and that's where like, you know, I made this site called Thousands Under 90, and it's, you can give yourself an award if you feel like you deserve an award because you got left out of every like 30 under 30 competition. And that's, it's a static site, you know, it's just like a simple page and there's like a form that you fill out and it fills out this certificate based on your input on the form, and it just doesn't have to be anything more than that, and it can just be small and delightful.
Are work and play like one and the same for you?
They definitely are. I mean, I feel like when I try to play and it doesn't involve work, it's like a lot harder for me to come up with stuff to do. So like now it's easy because I have a toddler. And so, you know, I can go to like petting zoos and stuff, and it's like, you know, there's tons of stuff to do. But prior to be reintroduced to little kid play, you know, anything that was playful was just me making art or like figuring out a way to make a project, you know, or letter pressing or silk screening or doing something.
I'm certain like you have a million people asking you for advice and whatnot. What question do you get asked the most often?
You know, I get a lot of emails from people when they hit a time in their lives when they feel like it's at a big transition time. And they're like, I feel like I'm stuck. I'm choosing between these two things. Like, help me. Like, I actually feel like the more generic questions, they come, but they usually come from students that have been asked to do interviews of professionals, or, you know, blogs or magazines that send everybody the same 10 questions or whatever. But the questions that I get asked most are actually super personal, and they have to do with like, hey, like you seem like this inspirational, like you're this inspirational person to me, but you seem also like down to earth. Like, how can you make sense of my situation right now? So I actually get these like really tough emails from people where they kind of explain their complete life situation at the time. And I try my best to like, you know, be the therapist to help them do it, because I actually feel like, the thing that is very important to me in terms of giving advice is that I don't like to give like pie in the sky, quit your day job. You know, like I don't give the like 20 years into the future advice. I give the advice for now, because that's how I live too. Like, I look at what's around me and I try to figure out like, wait, what about right now sucks? What about right now is amazing? Like, how do I do more of that amazing stuff that is right now? And I think that that's how I'm actually like the most risk averse person ever. Like, I'm not like a very risky person. I will never jump out of a plane. And I'm kind of like that with my career stuff too, where it's difficult for me to take these really big leaps. Like, I'm really good at kind of just like plugging away towards a direction if I know the general direction. And what I try to do is let people know that that's okay. You know, like it's okay to not, like if you're unhappy in your job, that you don't have to like go fuck everything. I need to move to New York and do this totally different thing. Because like you could do that, but it's really scary. And very few people actually have the resources and the ability to do that. And so what I want to do is help them make their life better in their exact situation that they're in right now. Because once like a lot of the pressure is off, then maybe they are capable of taking that huge leap. But when you're like in the middle of this desperate zone, like you're not good at like just quitting everything and like moving on to something crazy, you know, because it just seems impossible.
Well, and along with that, what's the most interesting question you've ever received?
Oh, the most interesting question. Oh man, that's a hard one. I feel like a lot of people have super interesting questions. I occasionally do like really weird interviews for blogs where they ask you like super specific, but totally unrelated.
Is this one of those interviews?
I don't think this is one of those interviews, but you know, it'll be like, you know, if you could take one snack food to whatever, you know, like what would that be? You know, and I really like it when questions are so specific and then you give just like a base, you know, whatever your answer is, but then you're like, wait, what would someone infer from that answer? Like, you know, if I say that my like ideal snack food would be a like Reese's cup, but only if it's frozen. And if it's not frozen, then it has to be a gummy candy. You know, like what can be inferred from that? Probably that I'm picky. And
that's funny. Well, Jessica, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah. Happy. This has been great. It was so good to talk to you.
That's going to be it for episode 8. If you enjoyed the show, I'd encourage you to subscribe. We're on iTunes and SoundCloud. Of course, if that's not your thing, you can always listen on the web at designernews.co/podcast. If you've got ideas for making this podcast better, please get in touch with us. We're on Twitter at designernewsbot, or you can reach out to me personally at Samuel R. Solomon. If you're interested in supporting the show, please get in touch with us about sponsorship opportunities. Once again, my guest is the incredibly talented Jessica Hish. I'm Sam Solomon, and this is DNFM.